Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
Hello and thank you for joining us once again. So today Maggie and I were feeling a little at a loss as to what we could talk about because as of this moment, nobody's asked us a question in particular. And we were both kind of looking at each other going, well, it's not quite time to talk about Halloween yet. And what shall we talk about? So I decided in my reasonably common witchy kind of a way that I would go to an oracle deck and pull a card on what was the perfect thing for us to talk about just now. And so I wanted to tell you which oracle deck and what the card said before we talk about this. So the oracle deck is called The Red Seeds 2, and it is by the artist Linda Hill, who has both done the paintings, written the words on the back, and quoted on every single card from Sappho. And these are beautiful. Sappho the poet. Mm. So the card that I pulled for us has a beautiful picture of a woman sitting amongst lavender. And the statement it says is, I am still. And the quotation from Sappho says, for greater than all gifts is peace, and strength is in the tranquil mind. And I really see how that is relevant to us and is the foundation for a really good conversation. So her goddess in this is the goddess Irene. Maybe that's how you say it, or maybe it's Irene, I don't know. Anyway. She was the Greek goddess personifying the state of peace. And she goes on, she says a little bit more about that goddess. And then the future's always full of uncertainty. Finding a place of peace within ourselves helps us to traverse changeable times. So, clearly pretty relevant to now. Finding time to connect with the stillness at the centre of our being through prayer, love, meditation, walking in nature, or just doing what we love can reveal our inner peace. She always has a little bit at the bottom that says the challenge and the gift. So the challenge in this card is worry, and the gift is serenity. And I would like you to ask, I would like Maggie to ask you, where do you find your serenity? I know that you do.
Oh, well, if I don't meditate in the morning, it's a bit of a scramble to get back to it. Mm-hmm. I find it incredibly important. And I generally meditate before I do anything else. We get up. Well, we get up, obviously. Let the dogs out, feed the chickens. Lan goes off to walk on his own or with whatever beagle we may have at the time. And I go to my office and light a candle and sit on the floor and meditate. And sometimes what the music I'm using at the moment, I don't usually use music, but there's something called the Devi Prayer on YouTube. If you just go to YouTube and go Hymn to the Divine Mother, and under that, there's a lady called Ananda and Craig something. I'm sorry, I don't remember the whole name of it. But it's this beautiful song to the different, to the great goddess, and mentions the pantheon of goddesses in the Hindu tradition. And she's repeating pretty much the same words, but I've just sat and let that wash over me lately. But there are other times when I want a silent meditation and to go inside, and there are days I don't manage it. But the discipline of showing up for it is where I find most of my peace. If I will have the discipline to show up to do something spiritual, there will be peace in that. Because when you've got the discipline, you can have the joy. It's this old polarity thing. Other ways of peace is to walk a beagle. By the time this is broadcast, we may have another beagle because we lost both ours this year. I don't know. But actually walking on my own has been very interesting because I've kept up the walking and I've found places just to sit on the moor by the river, which you generally don't do with a dog.
Mm.
You walk with the dog.
Yeah.
So that's been a very important thing, to sit by water. Yeah. And certainly in the autumn, to sit under rowan trees by water is just, for me, bliss.
Yes.
And to dangle bare toes in the water. And I walk barefoot whenever I can on the moor. And the other primary thing I do is every night I have a candlelit bath. And I'm just one of those bath people and shower people. Obviously, you can't have a candle in the shower. But I have a nice soak and I use scented oils. And I put them in milk. A friend of mine, Bernadette, taught me that. She's an aromatherapist. Because if you put oils in oil in the bath, the whole bath's sticky.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole family's going to fall over or slip. But if you put them in dried milk.
Dried milk.
Whole milk works very well. But I tried it in a pot of dried milk and it's beautiful. It's like an acid bath. It's really smooth, the water, and it carries the oils really well without making the bath sticky.
Wow.
So that's another important thing, and I like to go to bed after a bath, and I like to have that period, if we have watched TV or we have been reading or something like that, to have that boundary period of lying in the great mother's womb in the water. And I also do my appreciations. I think of 100 things I appreciate before I get up every morning, except Sunday. I take Sundays off. And 100 things before I go to bed.
Good grief. How long does that take?
About 5 minutes.
Well.
Maybe 10 minutes. But it's so good for me.
Mm.
And there were days when because both dogs died very close to each other, and that was really difficult. And I found it incredibly difficult then.
Really?
I did. Ooh. And I was just sort of going, thank you that they lived.
Yeah.
You know, and doing crying appreciations. It's making me cry again now. So I allowed myself a bit of leeway for a few days there, because you must never set something in stone that makes it a duty rather than a pleasure.
Mm.
And you have to turn it around. So I changed the appreciations just to thank you for my health. Thank you for my wealth. Thank you for my well-being. Thank you for my love. Thank you for this. And it's not necessarily having to be thankful. It's about appreciating stuff. And I also do at least 100 affirmations a day if I love and value myself.
Mm.
Because if I won't love and value myself, nobody else will.
No.
So I suppose it sounds like I do an awful lot, and yet I think I do absolutely diddly squat, but that's my practice.
That is a lot of practices. Wow. Okay. Amazing.
And you?
I just, before I answer that, I'm blown away because I thought I was about to be, was being very judgmental and I'm going to own up. I thought that I was about to receive some kind of treatise/lesson on how to do praying.
Well, we can talk about prayer if you like, but let's see what you do first.
Okay. After that, I want to talk about prayer because I'm intrigued. So how do I find stillness? Well, in one way, in the same way, in that I know that for me, going out in nature is the single best thing I could possibly do for myself.
Mm.
No matter what the weather, if I can go out and engage with the more than human world, I will be in a better, more nourished, more gentle place, no matter what's happening, than I was before. Also for me, if I know that worry is really gnawing away at me, and because that, you know, that if that's the challenge is worry and the gift is serenity in this particular thing. And if worry is really gnawing away at me, then to really turn around and face it, and I often find myself asking the question, what's the worst that could happen?
Oh, but you're Scorpio and I'm Scorpio Moon, and Scorpio does that.
Right, okay.
And yes, I find that incredibly helpful. If you go to the absolute worst and work back from that.
Yes, yeah.
And I had a friend who thought she was going to be diagnosed with breast cancer. It was a non-malignant tumour, so she was okay. And she was terrified. How would you not be terrified?
Yes.
But she was saying, but if I have chemo, I can't have children. You know, and I said, well, let's go to the worst case. That is the worst case as far as you see it. Fine. So you can have your eggs preserved.
Mm.
you know, but we were able to talk at, she was a Scorpio too, at the very worst level. And so she felt better having done that. So non-Scorpios, give it a go.
Sorry, yes, no. Well, I actually read an article once that I felt very validated by, because apparently it is, from the point of view of your mental health, it is a really good thing to do, is ask yourself, what is the actual worst that could happen? Because once you face the worst that could happen, you can start to strategize about what if that actually was the thing that happened. And that as soon as you've named it, faced it, and strategized around it, for a start, it's all an enormous relief when the worst thing doesn't happen. And so life becomes this endlessly sweet place, because typically the worst doesn't happen. And also that because you've given yourself the opportunity already to think about it, face it, and strategize it, you tend not to become overwhelmed by the situation if the worst actually does happen. And you already know something of what your response might be and what you might be able to do about that or whatever. Which,
and that's the opposite of toxic positivity, isn't it? Because you do see so many people just go, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine.
Yeah, it's all going to be fine.
It's all going to be fine, it's all going to be fine. And of course, positive thinking is very powerful, but I totally agree. Let's go down to the very depth first, and then we will be able to do the positive thinking. As in, okay, we know how we're going to handle this. In fact, of course, it would never happen quite like that, but it gives you the confidence. So now we can look for the better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also that when, I mean, I have to say, the daughter of two first-class catastrophists.
Disaster magnets.
Not disaster magnets. Just the one story, apologies, Mum, if you're listening, but the story that sticks out in my head of my mum is that in this regard, I sometimes say that she was the person who looked at a picture of a beautiful house which had an absolutely enormous and very beautiful tree next to it. And her first comment was, what if the tree fell on the house?
Well, Susie's mum, we lived in a house by a tree like that, and the tree did fall down in the opposite direction. And we stood in my mother's bedroom and watched it.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, to be fair, we also did have a tree that did fall on our house when I was a kid. And I also have had a branch off a tree from next door fall on a bit of my house. And
yeah, but it's a very valid point, because we certainly in Britain, and I think a lot of other cultures too, are just one thingers. You look at something and see it's perfect, but you're trained to go, but.
Right.
You know, how was the wedding? Oh, it was lovely. Right, it was a bit of meringue. You know, how was the colour?
Ouch.
How was the holiday? Oh, it was wonderful, but it was all ruined by the flight home. We seem to have this idea of pulling back to the negative.
Right.
As a kind of habit.
It's not a thing I suffer from, but.
No, I'm glad to hear it, and I'm getting better at not. But anyway, please do go on.
Anyways, well, having been raised by a pair of excellent catastrophists, I am myself a fantastic catastrophist. But, yes, perhaps it's my Scorpio-ness or whatever. My catastrophizing, I've learned to, on the one hand, realise what I'm doing. Oh my God, I'm feeling this utterly anxious or uptight or whatever it is. Because I'm worried, basically, bottom line. What are you worried about, Susie? Oh, well, I'm worried about this thing. And this thing, 9 times out of 10, you know, if I said it out loud to someone else, they would look at me probably with the deepest pity and go, really? And, you know, what makes you think that's going to happen? And the point is, for me, is that it could. And I guess I'm being very, you know, Job-like in some ways, although thank every God ever I have not called to me that which I most fear. But that it's, you know, these things, the things I worry about are, of course, the things I fear. And to try and face them down and on the one hand go, okay, that could happen. And frankly, if any of those things did happen at 11:30 at night, do you want to know now or would you rather know in the morning? Wouldn't you just rather have one more night where you didn't know that that was reality? And then I'll go, yes, please, thank you very much. If that really has happened, I'd like to know tomorrow. And actually, because there's not today, because the spirits and the gods, all of them are insanely kind to me. I tend to have reasonably quick confirmation that my darkest fear is not the case. But also, maybe having heard the story of Job as a child, I don't know, or just being very aware of we co-create our own reality with the gods, is that I will spend at least as much time expressing my gratitude for what is deliberately as I have spent time in worrying about what might be.
Absolutely.
And that I think that's really, really important to not, you know, sometimes I can't help myself. I will give energy to that which I worry about. But when I catch myself, I try and give at least as much energy in doing exactly what you do, only I don't do 100 of them. But maybe I should begin. Of just saying, you know, thank you. Thank you for everything. And thank you especially for this thing that I'm worrying about. Because I wouldn't worry about it if I didn't love. And that's the kind of fundamental tailback.
Yes.
Is, you know.
Absolutely. And yes, that was one of the things I was doing after the dogs had died, which was I'm grieving because I love.
Yeah.
And I have a heart that needs to love, and I will love again. Not yet, but there will be love again, and because of the love I had.
Yeah. And yeah, I don't know if you ever made it onto here, but you said the loveliest thing at that time, which was, they're worth it. Loving them, the joy, the bliss, the beauty, the nurture of loving them was worth all this pain.
I really get that. Thank you. I first said that after Henry, my first husband, died.
Right.
We knew each other 18 months. We were married for 1 year and 16 days. And people would always say to me, oh my God, you know, sorry. And I'd say it was worth it.
Yeah.
And even then I knew it was worth it. Just 1 year.
Yeah. Yeah. God, who wouldn't want 1 year of yumminess rather than not 1 year of yumminess?
Yeah, well, 7 months of it was miserable because he had cancer. But even so, it taught me so much about him, and we loved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so tell me about prayer then.
prayer is this. Well, the accepted norm, I think, is the idea that prayer is talking to God and meditation is listening to God.
Right.
And so there must be space in prayer. For listening.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And this is going to sound really weird or wanky bollocks. I've said that for days. in that there is a system called the Sacred Magic of Angels, which I learned from my bishop, David Goddard, who wrote a book called Sacred Magic of the Angels, about how to petition the divine through the angelics. And you use two different languages. You use the Theban script or the passing of the river script. And they're actually not exactly languages, but they're different formulations of the letters. And when I have a worry and I have a specific ask, I will either send healing, because I send healing to myself.
Mm-hmm. Good plan.
Or to the situation. Or I will formulate a prayer and make myself write it in the foreign language. Because that will make it shorter and succinct.
Mm-hmm.
Because the thing about prayer is that we get so confused in it. But for example, if I have to write something in the passing of the river script, I'll make quite sure it's one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Please assist me in learning this or doing that. Whereas if I am praying without preparation, I'll be going, oh God, let's give me an example. Oh God, I need more work. Oh God, I don't know how to pay the rent next week. I need another, I must organise another webinar. God, help me get an idea for a webinar. Or would a workshop be better? Or I don't know, shall I buy a lottery ticket? Or shall I just go out and apply for a job? Can I do? And we all do that. Do you know what I mean? So while you're sitting there saying, please help me, your mind is running on all these possible avenues. And your prayer just sort of goes up in a sort of wambly wobbly way. And I suspect the consciousness up there is going, yeah, but what do you want?
Which one, Maggie? Choose.
Yes, which one? Because I don't understand what you're on about at all. And the other point is one that was made by Paul Seton Byrne, who's the rector of the Widden Parishes and the vicar of St. Michael's in Chagford, who's a lovely guy, introduced me to Richard Rohr, for which I shall be perpetually grateful, and accepted me even though I was a foreign vicar in the wrong religion. And bless him. And he said he watches people go into the church, kneel down, pray, heave a sigh of relief because they've done the prayer, pick up the problem and walk out with it. And the idea of prayer, which is what makes it challenging for people, is that you ask for help, you put the problem down, and you walk away. And that's the story of Hannah in the Bible. That's exactly what she does. She goes to the temple and asks for a child, and then lives confidently that either she'll have a child, or there'll be a really good reason that will be revealed to her why she is not to have a child.
Trust.
Trust. Yes, so the purpose of prayer is to learn trust. Because there's always an answer to prayer. And sometimes the answer is not now, no, it wouldn't be good for you. And it's important to be willing to accept that. But I will always, I'm lucky I will get a sign that will tell me that. But nowadays I don't tend to ask for things that I don't think will be good. And the phrase that Jesus is said to have used in the Garden of Gethsemane is so useful, because I'll say, please, may my friend Adam receive all the healing he needs to be healed.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, not my will, but thy will be done.
Mm-hmm.
The best for Adam's soul.
Yeah, really, I think that's really important.
Yeah.
That so the way it was explained to me, I think the most clearly was within the context of the offering of prayers for another, and that it's so important with all of these things, for ourselves, for other people, if we're sending prayers, sending healing, whatever, is that the prayer, the healing, whatever, the intention is an offering which the other can receive or not as they will, not a sending.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can offer you, for example, a healing intention, and it's up to you whether you receive it. Whereas if I send you a healing intention, it's going to kind of smack into you.
Yes.
And if it's not appropriate, it's going to be there as a bit of unwanted kind of, it's like I've, you know, chucked a boiled egg at you or something. It's there, stuck to your being, not required, not wanted, not actually doing you any good, and utterly unethical because you didn't ask me for it.
Yes.
And so to have in our prayers for other people and for ourselves the idea that, you know, if this is in alignment with what is in for the greatest good, then so may it be.
Yeah. There is also the prayer of emergency, which is please help.
Yes.
Help now, help now, help now, help now. And that is answered so often, if only in your own calmness.
So what about prayers, like the written down ones in the book, Job?
Well, they can be very useful, because even if you're only gabbling them without really thinking about them, you're still reprogramming the neural pathways of the brain with those words.
Mm-hmm.
I had a friend who was a monk, and he and his wife, because he demonked himself for this lovely girl, and they got married, and they've been happily married for a long time, and there's a whole story in itself. But they had a spirited discussion about whether prayer had to be intentional or whether it could just be done by rote, and he said the ones by rote still work.
Wow, okay.
I don't know, but I think they work in reprogramming you rather than necessarily going through. And there's also these things you always have to address with prayer. It's why on earth would God be merciful to somebody else because I asked? That's no kind of God that I want to be a part of.
Mm.
But that's what most people think prayer is about. I'm praying for her, therefore you, God, will now notice her because you hadn't noticed her before until I, the good person, prayed for her. And a lot of people do work like that, but that's not how it works. It's actually about your focus on that person, because we are all one.
Mm-hmm.
It's just inviting the rejected ray, if you like, to reconnect if they want it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just like a slight reweaving, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But what would you say is the difference between prayer and healing?
The difference between prayer and healing? I don't. For me, maybe I've misunderstood the word prayer, but for me, prayer is a conversation with the divine, and healing is wholeness, which is in many ways, well, it's definitely not definitely not. It's not so much a conversation with the divine as union with ourselves, which therefore implies union with the divine, and implicit in our wholeness is our connection to the divine. And so to me, the healing is the actualization of the wholeness, and the prayer is the invitation to that wholeness.
Yes, it's an interesting one. I think about this a lot and try and work it out for myself, because nobody says you shouldn't be allowed to pray for somebody, but there are ethics about sending healing to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, as we've said, prayer can be a very negative thing to do for somebody, and healing could be a very negative thing to do for somebody. And I've never really quite worked out what the difference is, because I do send healing. It's one of the things I do in the bath at night. But I also will pray for folk.
But you wouldn't send healing to somebody who hadn't asked for it.
No.
No, so that's the difference.
Yeah,
is
the whole difference.
Yeah.
Whereas, and healing, I think the idea of healing is that you do calm yourself, centre yourself, focus on the situation, which of course is what prayer is meant to be also.
Yeah.
So there's not really that much difference.
Yes, okay. As from the point of view of sending it.
Well, from the point of view of trying to help somebody who's ill, say, you pray for their recovery or you send healing for their recovery.
Yes, because when you're using the word send healing, but what you're doing is offering an intention.
Yes, I know. I never send healing.
No, exactly.
I invoke the divine to send the healing.
Yeah, so they are, in that context, they're one and the same thing,
yes,
I would suggest.
I would say so.
Yeah.
Yeah. So why did we take expensive courses to learn healing?
Why do we take expensive courses to learn healing? Explain.
I don't know the answer to that myself, but because we don't understand that we have the right to pray. P-R-A-Y, not P-R-E-Y. But you can go on a Reiki healing course,
yeah,
and learn how to send healing, whereas you could just learn how to pray.
Yeah.
But we tend to, in the holistic world, to rather go on the healing course rather than praying. Do you think it's because prayer is too associated with Christianity?
I suspect that the word is associated with Christianity. But, I mean, for me, the reason why I would and did attend a course, and the why I would invite people to attend my courses, would be that it's that there are particular techniques which are specific, you know, very particularly useful, and that for me the really important thing is that it's all about clarity, and that it's about clarity of intention, clarity of attention, clarity of the your sense of the world in which you belong, and how that can be changed by your attention and intention. And that, if we go back to the idea that in this relation, prayer and healing are very much the same thing, you would attend a healing course maybe for exactly the same reason that you might, that you, for example, would construct a prayer in another language. Mm. Because we need to learn how to hone that intention and attention and consider all things, so that we make sure that what we as a practitioner, as the prayer, as the healer in inverted commas, that what we're doing is only good and does no harm. Because both instances, actually, we the human are merely clarifying an intention. The action is done by the divine. The healing, the answering of the prayer, is done by the divine. And so, for me, you attend a course so that you may learn to hone your intention and hold your attention and get the really good skills, the really good prayers, the precisely the exact words for the spell that's going to make the gods make it so.
I think that's a perfect answer, and that makes so much sense to me, because if you learn, go to a healing course, and I've been to quite a few, the good ones teach you to become the vessel before you start, to be still.
Yeah.
as you were talking about at the beginning, exactly yeah. it, to be still so that the intention is clarified. And that's the trouble with prayer is there's a lovely guy called David Yule who runs Soul Space in South Zeal. It isn't running at the moment, obviously, but it has for, it was the first event or thing I went to after we moved to Devon 8 years ago. I just saw this sign outside the church in the village which said Soul Space every Tuesday. It was a half hour meditation, silent meditation led by prayer. And I turned up the first Tuesday and I've never left. I've been every single week it's on, and I lead it the first Tuesday of the month, which is jolly good of them to trust me to do that. And it's just, David says the trouble with the liturgy is it's so busy. You go to a church, if you can go to a church at the moment, and it's just all recited. There's no sitting with it.
Sorry, I don't know the words. Explain what the liturgy is.
Liturgy is the text that you read at a service.
Right.
The text that you follow at a service. You're doing a communion service or evensong or something, and there's what's known as a liturgy, which is the stated words that the minister must say.
Right, okay. All of them.
Yes.
Right, okay.
All of them. But it's always busy. The minister starts it off and says the this, and then we have the hymn, and then we might have the sermon, and then with the prayers and the this. But there's no space in it. So in prayer, we haven't been taught the sitting, the becoming the vessel, the communion with the divine. I mean, communion is very rarely communion, because you can get to sit down afterwards while you're waiting for everybody else to go up for the communion. But most people just sort of sit there and go, I'm bored now. You know, you don't have the, or think, oh, can I check my mobile phone while nobody's watching? You know?
No way, really? Oh, do people do that?
God, somebody ate their breakfast in church once, but that was quite amusing and appropriate because she was diabetic and she needed a breakfast. But
right.
Anyway, I took a photograph of her, actually. She was lovely. So I think they're both the same in that you have to be silent and still and focused and give up the issue to the divine. So, but prayer has become so rushed and so active. So I think probably the resurgence in healing is a way of relearning prayer, the original prayer. And the desert fathers in the first centuries of Christianity were the desert fathers and the desert mothers too, the therapeutae outside Alexandria. They spent a long time in solitude, in the desert, in desert spaces, just being empty vessels, emptying themselves, so that when they needed to be full, they could fill themselves with what they needed. They did that through prayer and meditation. And I would say prayer and meditation equals healing, I think. But it's been really useful. Do go on.
Who are these therapeutae? I've never heard of any desert mothers before.
Oh, the therapeutae were a group outside in the desert outside Alexandria. And they formed themselves before Christianity. I researched them when I wrote the second of the books about Deborah, Jesus's cousin, the fictional books that I wrote. She goes to Alexandria with her husband and explores the therapeutae because she's looking for a more meditative experience than the very intellectual one at the Alexandrian library. And so the therapeutae were men and women. They usually segregated from each other, as in they weren't having sexual relationships with each other. So it was like a convent and a monastery, but they did associate with each other. And they, so they're basically a bit like the Shakers or the Amish, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
They were reclusive in a community.
Right.
So, but yes, there were definitely desert mothers. But of course, in those days, as a woman was generally a possession, you'd have to have a community like the therapeutae, which would have men and women, so it was protected, if you see what I mean.
Right, because you couldn't be a community of women by yourselves.
I don't know that it was safe. I don't know, but there generally weren't that many communities of women. The Essenes, which people talk about a lot, the inner group of the Essenes was celibate men, but the Essene group had families, men and women, places like Qumran, places like that. So there were always have been groups of people who withdrew from the main to live a kind of monastic life.
Mm-hmm. And am I right in thinking that Jesus's family were Essene?
Probably not.
Oh, okay.
Probably not, for the simple reasons that the Essenes would not go to the temple.
Uh-huh. They thought it was corrupt, and Jesus did.
Right.
And the Essenes, they didn't drink alcohol, which Jesus plainly did.
Okay.
And several other aspects, which I can't remember off the top of my head. But it's unlikely. I think I wrote in the Book of Deborah that he was heavily influenced by the Essenes.
Right.
Which I think was probably so. I mean, he was. I don't think he went to India. I don't think he went to Alexandria, because everything he needed and everything he taught was in his own tradition.
Yeah.
And it wasn't really that common for people to potter off to India and study
great gurus.
Great gurus over there, because anyway, he was just getting it from God.
Yeah.
You don't need to go and do that kind of thing. You don't need to travel. Oh, it's lovely to travel to the other end of the world to see a guru if you can, but you don't need it.
No.
It's all back at home. So I think he was probably very interested and very aware of all the groups around him, but he was getting it straight through.
Mm-hmm.
But okay. Nobody will ever know.
No, indeed. No, indeed.
We're on 35 minutes.
Oh my goodness, it's almost like we're getting used to this.
It almost is. So basically, stillness. Yes. It's winter. Winter is coming. Be still.
Winter's coming. Yes.
Winter is coming. There's a lovely prayer I would like to close on.
Oh, go on then.
Well, it's known, be still and know that I am God, which is a phrase from the Bible. And you can start off, you go, be still and know that I am God. Be still and know. Be still and. Be still. Be.
And on that note of beautiful invocation. Happy Friday. See you next week.